Sorrow Podcast. This is your weekly podcast for movies and television and entertainment, but mostly movies, and mostly featuring me and my co-host Eric Sayor.
Hello.
And I am Arlen Haro, of course. And this week we're continuing our theme of talking about movies of the of a spooky and horrific nature, and we're kind of going with things that are supernatural in terms of, you know, scope and where they fit within the horror genre. So yeah, this week. So if that doesn't interest you, leave now. But please don't, because we love you. So yeah.
This week we're going really into classics.
Yes.
Again. Movies I hadn't seen, so I was very excited to do more of that stuff. I've been watching horror movies for the past couple of weeks at this point. I've had at least one nightmare because of them.
That's understandable.
But yeah,
so I've seen your list, and it's pretty good. So yeah.
Okay, so we'll start with the earliest of our picks for this week, which is the best of the movies we're going to talk about, I think.
Probably. Yeah. I would argue.
The scariest. Yeah. The scariest, for sure.
Yeah.
The Exorcist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Directed by William Friedkin. Is, you know, a classic film director of the 70s because of this movie. If you don't know his films, go and watch them, because a lot of them are pretty great, except for some of his more recent ones. But yeah,
and French Connection are super good movies.
Yes. And this movie is written by William Peter Blatty, who went on to direct Exorcist 3, which is also good if you haven't seen it. But yeah, I feel like this movie is... I feel like it transcends horror in a way. And I feel like most people know The Exorcist, even if they haven't actually seen The Exorcist. Because it's left this sort of mark on the culture in a weird way. And it's been, like most of the movies we've talked about so far in previous weeks, it's just been copied to death.
Also, it's two movies I think we talked about today. I knew a bunch about just because of how they're so ingrained into it. And this movie has so many scenes that I've seen in other stuff. Family Guy.
Yeah. If you grew up with the Scary Movie franchise, and particularly the second one, they recreate frame for frame the ending of this movie at the beginning of that one. So, yeah. But this is a movie that I feel like it's the last 30 minutes that everybody remembers, at least, or that really, like, left a lot of those marks. Because the first section of this movie is fairly... I'm not going to say nothing happens, but it's a lot of setup, and it's a lot of, like, building of tension, and there's spooky stuff throughout, but it all is sort of building towards the ending, which is sort of more typical of horror up until this point, and up until sometime in the 80s.
From the beginning of this... The really not the first few shots, but after that, when it starts just in Iraq, which I wasn't expecting at all, felt very much a surprise. And I think it's those scenes set up the world in an interesting way, all through like without painting precise. It's Max von Sydow facing a statue of the devil, like he's gonna face the devil later in the film. Seen in that image yellow and it does a lot for me to talk about good and evil facing.
It really like it sets up sort of the allegorical nature of the movie, and it is very allegorical. If anybody's ever listened to the commentary for this movie, William Friedkin talks a lot about how throughout the movie his characters are either rising or they are descending, visually in the frame. So constantly you see Damien going downstairs, down, into a subway line or something of that nature, until you get to the end where it's him going up a set of stairs. And so there's a lot of allegorical stuff in this movie of that nature. And Friedkin is very smart about his visuals and how he juxtaposes things. And he thinks about things in that way. And it pays off in the movie, I think. Very well. And there are shots that feel like they're from a painting. A lot of the time, they feel like dark abstractionists' work that's just been put on screen. It's a very impressive movie. Considering what I feel like a lot of people assume about 70s or pre-70s films, that some of them are probably less so.
Yeah, you broke up for a bit, so I.
Oh, sorry. That happened on the other side for me as well.
What I think this movie is so much about fate and the director trying to work out through his fate in a way. I don't know that much about William Friedkin, but I'm pretty sure he grew up Christian after watching this movie, and it's all it takes that struggle to keep your faith as you grow older and manifest it through a literal fight against evil, and making his character take facing something greater than themselves and having to be greater than themselves in their moments when they're the weakest.
That's the gist of the movie, essentially. Like that's really what it's all leading up to. And I believe you're right, Friedkin is somewhat of a religious guy, but the guy who's very, very religious in all of this is actually William Peter Blatty. He was very Catholic. That's the only way I can describe it. He was just short of being a priest. I believe he might have been a priest at one point. I don't remember the exact facts about him as a person, but yeah. But both of them are men who have very much struggled with that idea, and it shows in the movie, and it adds another layer to it of, you get the sense that these people have personally dealt with those questions about what they believe and why do they believe it.
I think this movie is also just a fun watch and a scary watch. It's filled with awful imagery and like descends faster and faster into like something that's ends up being completely horrifying, both to the characters and to you watching it. And I think it still works as that. It's still horrifying to watch that girl walk down the stairs on her back.
Yeah.
And just vomit blood.
It is important to point out we did watch the director's cut, which is a little bit beefier than the regular cut. But yes, so her going down the stairs backwards is just it's unnerving. Yes, a lot of it, the head turning is still disturbing as well. Everything, anytime where it's the little girl just saying some of the worst possible things before the makeup, just when it's like her. That stuff is all very hard to watch, I think.
Yeah, and I think that actress does an incredible job. I think she sells it so well that she's that same girl from the beginning, and also she's possessed by the devil.
Yeah, definitely. Her performance feels part of a piece. It doesn't feel like a different person taking over, which is impressive because for various points it was like three different people in various versions of that makeup. And so yeah, it's impressive on that level.
Yeah.
I think one of the scariest things to me still is when they keep on cutting to the demon, just the face. That white face with those yellow eyes that they'll just cut in between frames randomly.
Yeah, I didn't notice that at first. I'm glad I was watching with someone more attentive than me. That's like, did you see that? I'm like, no.
Yeah.
Yeah. Multiple times. Yeah, no, it's so unsettling, and you blink and you miss it at the same time.
Yeah.
And yeah. So it makes you almost question, is it supposed to be there? Is it voluntary?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I can't imagine watching it when it came out in the theaters and just seeing those frames that feel just out of place, out of another movie.
Right. Yeah. And at the time where people were playing their records backwards to see if the devil was talking to them and all these other things of that nature, it was probably very unnerving for a lot of people. That one, that always gets me. That statue of Pazuzu, actually, is the name, in case you were curious. That statue of Pazuzu and the way that it's used throughout the movie, it's still very unnerving. I like that it sort of just like appears in the room with them. And just the lighting also is gorgeous, and just the setups, and
I love that when Von Sydow comes into play, gets into the house, he knows what's happening, and they both know they're facing each other again.
Yeah, he feels it. And this is the thing I can't believe I didn't notice before, but the fact that the demon is warning about him, that's something that that was just interesting to me. And the idea that these are two characters who have sort of been having this battle for a very long time, and it's their constant thing that they do over and over again. That was something that was very interesting.
I think a character that really makes that movie works for me is Aras, the priest that's also a psychiatrist for other priests, and that's questioning his own faith because he's the one that has to deal with priests questioning their own faith. He feels Linda Blair, that is the mother, Chris's mother, is set out to be like the kind of the moral center. She's the one that has to deal with with that, but I don't think the movie is that interested in her
I agree.
as much as it could have been, as much as which I feel is almost to its detriment horror wise. Like I feel making a movie that's almost lonely about being about a mother would be for me much more scary in the same vein as something like Babadook is or Under the Shadow. Those movies that sees one parent going completely insane because of dark forces affecting their child is some of the most terrifying stuff there is. But I don't think the movie is that interested in that.
It's interesting because those I think those two movies owe a lot to this. A lot to this in terms of just Ellen Burstyn and her reactions. And I know that at the time when the movie came out, for a lot of people, the scariest stuff wasn't really any of the demon stuff or any of the occult stuff. For some of them, it was, if they had children, it was watching Reagan go through those operations, and watching her hooked up to those machines
Oh,
and just,
those machines are terrifying. The sound they make, how she screams when she's strapped to a machine, it's all so unnerving. It's hard to watch, and there's no need for gore because it's you just see the child a child suffer, and that's enough.
And it really works. It really does, and it almost makes it, I mean, it doesn't make it okay, but it almost makes it fine. Again, I'm not even gonna say that. It almost makes it worth it that Linda Blair's life was kind of ruined by this movie, I guess. She kind of had some mental problems after this one, which I believe it. I get it. I can see why. But she had a hard time after this movie. You can just call it Linda Blair's the 80s, and then you'll see why. But yeah, like she does very well throughout this movie, and it's great because when I think of 70s movies and the whole stereotype about bad actors, I think that that comes from 70s movies. And she really stands out in this, compared to even other movies that came out at the time.
I kind of I think I made a mistake talking about Linda Blair when I wanted to say Ellen Burstyn.
Oh,
Yeah,
okay.
it was meant to be. I think the movie kind of would have been more interesting if the not more interesting, but more scary for me if the mother was the center of the story. Like it was told more from the point of view of the mother and how
Yes.
she's unable to deal with it. And I what I meant is the movie is not the movie uses that and uses that kind of well,
Yeah.
but is not that interested in that story. It's way more interested
Yeah.
in Kara's story.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's, yeah. I agree. It could have focused on her more,
But
and I think that
I
that would have
don't
been
think
more
that's what the
interesting.
movie is, but I think that's a way to make it more scary because the scariest parts of are the ones that you mentioned, like watching her watch her daughter suffer, watching her unable to do anything when her daughter is hurting herself.
Yeah, that is the scariest stuff, I think. I think Damien is there sort of to be the sacrificial lamb, I guess.
I
That's
don't know.
sort of his purpose.
I think the movie is more, from my point of view, telling his story of dealing with his lack of faith that I mentioned before, and dealing with his guilt, and using that as not maybe he's the one with agency in that story. Like he uses that agency and saves Regan, and that's I think that's where all the religious that's a religious redemption.
That is also part of it. That is true. Yeah, that's all in there. And I think his story is interesting. And I think it resolves itself well. And I think he gives a really, really strong performance in this movie. I think he's probably the best, I would say.
Except probably Linda Blair.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, because there's something about him. There's an everyman quality to him, yet there's a sense that this is someone who's educated and has a strong point of view about the world. Yeah. Even if he is going through a crisis of faith, you get the sense that this is an individual and he knows who he is.
Yeah.
And there's something great that he adds through that.
Yeah, I think there's like strength in that character. I love the scene where he talks to the cop. I think that's like where he's just like, yeah, you can't fuck with me.
Yeah,
he's like a, he has this this kind of rocky air about him that I really like.
Yeah, that's not just because of the boxing scene, is it?
No. I think he does.
I know.
I just think he has that, like,
yeah,
that look.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I said, he has an everyman thing about him.
Yeah,
which is just it's there. You can feel it in him. And the cop, he's not amazing in this movie, but it did. I recently did watch The Exorcist 3 as well. And it was fascinating to me how much, and that character is played by a different person in Exorcist 3, but their performances are completely in sync, and they feel like the same character. So that's just something interesting about the cop that I wanted to point out real quick. Let's see. I'm trying to see if there's anything else I wanted to talk about. Max von Sydow doesn't age, apparently.
Yeah.
Although I know he had a lot of makeup on for this.
You know, I make no sense for me that he looked that old.
Yeah. It's like, wait, he's how old now? But yeah, he's...
He looks as old as he does in Force Awakens.
Yep. Yeah, it looks like he just time traveled from
not 50, 40 years later.
40, yeah, it's
45
like,
years later. He looks,
it's crazy. Yeah, like if I was to go back in time and give best makeup effects to anybody, I would give it to the people from The Exorcist, because they nailed it. He's fantastic. I think even in bad movies, Max von Sydow was probably great. He's just one of those guys who can do that. Let's see. Is there anybody else I wanted to shout out? Also, I figured you might find this interesting. William Peter Blatty's he's the youngest child of Lebanese immigrants. That's something that,
which makes it for me very unsurprising that he's super religious. Especially before the 70s, Lebanon was like probably 70-80% Catholic. So,
right.
Very unsurprising.
Yeah. Just a little note there. Okay, I'm good to move on for now.
I think Exorcist is like really good.
Yeah. If you somehow haven't seen it, go watch it.
It holds up very well. It does feel a bit long in the beginning, but I think it picks up a rhythm fast, and when it does, it degenerates even faster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So go watch The Exorcist, and The Exorcist 3, and the TV show, because I like that as well. So, yeah. Don't watch those prequels. Don't do it. Or The Exorcist 2, The Heretic. Just, no.
Oh, that's bad, too.
I haven't seen it, but apparently it suffers from a problem that a lot of 80s horror sequels did, which is they just took footage from the first movie and they made a wraparound. So it's mostly flashbacks from Reagan to the first movie. That's a thing that they did because, again, Hollywood. All right. Our next film is Poltergeist, correct? Yes. Yeah. Poltergeist, the film that was directed by Toby Hooper, definitely not Steven Spielberg, never. Toby Hooper's Poltergeist, released 1982, 10 years after Exorcist, almost, actually. I guess let's start with, what were your sort of general thoughts on this movie?
Like a horror movie for a 12-year-old? I don't know if that makes sense. It's like it's a Spielberg horror film, so it's everyone can watch that. It's pretty universal. It's not it's never that scary, but if I was like 10 or 12 years old, that would have scared the shit out of me. I would have had nightmares for sure.
I agree. Yeah. Well, it's interesting, and my little thing about Toby Hooper and Steven Spielberg, that's a debate that will go on, and we'll have to wait till Steven Spielberg dies to know who actually directed this film, because nobody's going to confirm it or deny it until then. But there are moments in this where it feels very violent and very egregious, like when that man picks his own face off. And that is very Toby Hooper all the way. But I agree, like there's the universal sense of it, and the way that it plays on these sort of basic fears is frightening. And then also the hook of the movie, which is the fact that in the 80s TVs would just turn off, they would just stop having programming, at least here, and sort of playing on that feeling of waking up and your TV just having static on. There's a lot of sort of stuff that you would see in a day-to-day that it uses to as fodder for horror, in a way that movies before didn't necessarily do. A lot of haunted house movies were like giant mansions and old gothic houses that are already scary, just looking at them. So, yeah, this movie sort of did something different in that sense. I think this one laid out a lot of the sort of tropes that you get from haunted house movies.
I think it does. Like I said, it feels very, like, a suburban family, pretty well off. Three kids, two girls, a boy. You know, it does the setup of being anyone and being very personable, very well. And then again, like you said, it's for the time, it's probably like, oh yeah, that's us that we see on TV, that we see in this movie.
Yeah, it does feel like a time capsule.
Yeah. And on the Spielberg end of things, the movie starts and it's like a Steven Spielberg movie. And it ends and it says a Steven Spielberg movie. So,
yeah, it's interesting.
It uses... Spielberg does this thing a lot that other directors use, of course, but like he's mastered it more or less. That's like longish takes that just follow a simple action, and this movie does that a lot and does that very effectively and does that exactly like a Spielberg film.
You can feel Spielberg's hand on the movie quite a
And
bit.
the movie cues, no, the music cues, I mean, are again very like it only needed a Williams soundtrack. It would score, and it would have been a felt like a perfect building movie.
Definitely. And I mean, on that note, Jerry Goldsmith, I think he nails this score. It's creepy, but I don't think it ever tells you how you're supposed to feel, which is something that can happen in certain Spielberg movies. But yeah, I mean, not that it doesn't do that at all, but there are very few moments where I'm like, oh, I'm supposed to be happy now, or I'm supposed to be sad.
No, it's just it really well what's happening, and it does like having a theme.
But yeah.
Is kind of is essential to make a movie. It's essential, I think, to pop culture. Speaking of, we didn't talk about the Exorcist music and which I didn't know at all before watching. Before.
I'm sorry, you broke up a little
Oh yeah,
bit.
no, I just mentioned that the Halloween's theme music taking a lot of inspiration from The Exorcist.
Oh, yeah, I can see that. I can definitely see that. Especially Tubular Bells, which I guess was a song that existed before. I don't, yeah. But yeah, no, I can definitely see that. That song, it sort of has a similar, it does a similar thing for the movie. And yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, okay.
You mentioned the scene where the guy pulls off his face, and I think that scene feels out of another Way scary. I love it. I love how it just like it's that set the tone in that movie. A different place that you'd expect. Like the last 20 minutes are a complete descent into horror. That bit, whereas the beginning is a lot more adjacent. Ghostbusters, but serious.
Yeah, the movie does sort of, it starts much lighter and a lot more like a Spielberg kids film, and then as it goes on, it becomes scarier and it feels more like a different type of movie. Like a much darker, more sinister film as it goes on. Which is why I do think it was a co-direction, but this was pre-Coen Brothers for the most part. At least in terms of them being a known property, and nobody was fighting for co-directorness at that time. And it was still very much not a thing that you could really do and get away with, even if you were Spielberg. So yeah, I do think that I think they shared it, and then Tobe Hooper was given the title because he was not as big as Spielberg, and Spielberg didn't need the title.
Spielberg had his name on it. It's where you do get a story by credit.
Because originally, and I'm sure a lot of people already know this, this started off as an E.T. sequel, which that's not hard to tell or guess. But it started out as a movie where another race of aliens came down, and then at the end, E.T. came to help fight the other aliens. Which sounds like a much worse film, a far, far worse film. But the DNA is there.
I'm just reading off Wikipedia, but it says Close Encounters sequel, not a...
Oh, it might have been Close Encounters sequel. I know it went through a lot of different versions. Conceived the idea of Close Encounters. The material developed at the same time was used in Poltergeist and E.T. It sounds like it was sort of incestuous. For all three films.
Spielberg wasn't... He had to do E.T. So...
Mm-hmm.
So, which is why he got Toby Hooper, but still was kind of hands-on, which makes more sense.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense, in fact. I haven't seen any of Hooper's films
yet. They're much more like the darker moments in this. I mean, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, of course, is his, so... Yeah.
It's on my list of...
That one, and a favorite of mine from the Phantom Zone podcast called Life Force. The film where they stole their CG models for... for Rogue One. let's see. I don't know. This movie's kind of... It's an interesting movie, but I don't really have a lot of strong opinions on this film. Other than I think it for the most part, it works. I think it still holds up. So, yeah.
I love the ending.
Yeah.
I love that it ends in a... they just leave, and house disappears, and they go to the motel they planned to go to when they were leaving, and that's it. It ends, and then it gets their life.
Yeah, again. It ends. They throw their TV out of the room.
Yes.
Which is a great bit. Yeah. A great way to end the movie. Yeah, there's some interesting stuff. I mean, since we talked about child actors in The Exorcist, I went back and forth on them in this movie. Sometimes I thought that they were really good. Sometimes I did not think that they were very good at all. But Carrie Ann was probably the strongest of them, I would say.
Very good at doing faces. Like scared faces. Like he looks terrified in parts, and it's always like it always helps the context of that scene. I think that little girl looks kind of creepy, which makes it all work better.
I agree with that. I do like when the teenage girl tells the construction workers to kind of fuck off. That's pretty great.
It felt a bit
weird.
It felt a bit weird when the father is like mentions the motel on the on the side of the highway, and she's like, "Oh yeah, I remember that place."
Yeah, that's.
This movie has like weird jokey lines that kind of feel from another movie, like when the mother is about to go into the portal,
right?
And the weird, okay, we have to talk about the weird old lady, but after I mentioned this, but she's like, "You've never done this," and the mother answers, "You've never done this either," and she's like, "Okay, just go."
Yeah, that's It's pretty good. I think you're
And
talking about Zelda Rubinstein. Is she the old woman? She's as Tangina Behrens. She's interesting in this movie.
is voice? Did they just add a child's voice?
No, I think that's her real voice. That's
Because
a
she
real.
just sounds like a 10-year-old, and I think that's kind of the goal of it, and I think it gives the whole thing a kind of weird gravitas, and a lot, but it does sound like a 10-year-old.
She's technically I don't know if this term is right now. Technically she's a dwarf. Don't nobody throw anything at me if I'm not supposed to use that one anymore. But yeah, she's that's part of why her voice sounds like that though. Because of the way her vocal cords work and all that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Get
So,
out. Now
but
I
yeah,
feel
no
much
she
lapping up about her voice.
No, yeah, it's
I think it
I'm
did
just
good.
like
I
the train
think
got started and I couldn't stop it, so
it did. I'm very sorry. I feel bad. I think that the voice does wonders for the character, actually.
No, I agree actually. It does it helps a lot with that character.
Okay. Yeah. But the best part of this movie is the parents. Their relationship is works very well. It's so good when you're introduced to them about smoking a joint in their room when the children are sleeping, and they're just like making jokes at each other, and it is very like it's very believable as a relationship. It's very believable that they know each other super well. They like making each other laugh. They still like and love each other a lot. That kissing scene just before she goes in the portal is like, again, incredibly believable. I think the way the mother gets like kind of excited when she can show her husband that the chair is moving on the floor. The way like they react very differently to the kids. It's all very good. I think they give the movie a moral center that works and that's immediately likable and that makes you care about that family and that relationship.
There's something about their relationship that just feels very plucked out of reality. And it grounds the movie in an interesting way. And just a quick note, Craig T. Nelson from Spokane, Washington. So, there you go. David Lynch and Craig T. Nelson, two amazing stars in the world from my hometown. So, best place to be. No, he has this he also has that sort of everyman quality to him, that just makes him immediately likable. That's why he works so well as Mr. Incredible, because it's in his voice, even seems.
Last thing I want to mention is I love that the movie starts and it's just the dog. You get introduced to every character through the dog. It's a good dog. I like it a lot.
He's a good boy. All movies should start that way with a dog. Instantly we'll like it more. But yeah, no, I mean, we don't give enough credit to dog actors in general in this world. Good dog acting there.
Don't know why he
and I
disappears for like an hour and a half.
he does it's a little weird, but yeah, I do like that he gets the chips, that he gets them, and he that was very rewarding. More movies about
Chips,
dogs.
but
What?
yeah.
I have not been replaced by a dog. Help me, I've been taking work for
Do you have anything else to add on Poltergeist?
No, I have nothing else really to say about Poltergeist other than if you haven't seen this one, I recommend it. It's
If you have
yeah.
like someone younger in your
Yes.
Like a 10-year-old niece or nephew. I think that introduce a kid to horror, kind of.
Yeah, it's I agree. It's a good sort of starter. You know, if you have a kid who's really into Goosebumps, but they've watched all of it, all the Goosebumps, and they have none left, show them this. This is sort of the next step up. I'm sure there's some in-between movie that I'm not thinking of, but this is a good one. Okay. Now let's move on to Nightmare on Elm Street.
The one thing that ties all those movies very well together, I think, is the how they end in a very, like, how do I say that? In a very succinct way, like, it just ends. And you're left there. And sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. Most of the time it's both. But still.
Yeah. Yeah. They all kind of end unresolved in an interesting way. The Exorcist ends very sad. This movie ends in a way that's it leaves you satisfied, I think. That's how I would describe it. But with the sort of I guess what are some of specific thoughts that you have about this movie to start off with?
You like Freddy. I think he's like a fun killer. I like that he makes jokes. I like that he's just like kills people in their dreams. I find the whole conceit of it really well done, and I think that having him as the killer just works.
Yeah.
And I think every other character is like just all right.
That's like fair. Things
to get killed.
I completely agree. Like, the two people who I care about in this movie are sometimes Nancy.
Yeah.
Sometimes. And there are points where young Johnny Depp, which is what I'm going to call him for this whole thing, young Johnny Depp, because he's not the same person yet. he's a different human being. There are moments where I really care about young Johnny Depp, because there's an innocence to him that we don't have in current Johnny Depp or early Johnny Depp. Everybody else is kind of disposable.
I like that the movie just switches to the protagonist. It starts with the girl, she dies, and then it's Nancy becomes the protagonist by default. And
It does sort of a psycho thing a little bit.
Yeah. And like how the movie sets up the roof it affects the real world.
The rules are very well. The rules are so well handled in this movie. I think that's one of the strongest things about the script, is that by the time you get to the end, everything feels like it pays off well. Everything from Nancy realizing that he's basically just a tulpa and he really has no power, and her sort of bringing him into the real world, and all those elements, it all works, so that by the end, when it becomes Home Alone a little bit,
Alone, so
and you're like, maybe people should be saying it becomes Nightmare on Elm Street from now on. And it really works. And that's the other thing also. I noticed that Freddy, he remains scary even when you take him out of the dream. And that's something that's really hard to do, I feel like. But he remains intimidating, even in the real world.
I like his face.
His design is great. His design, Robert Englund's performance, his just everything about him, his voice, just the way he really kills it in this movie. And yeah, just yeah, he's great. He's fantastic.
I like how this movie as like they try to hold or use a there's a nothing kind of helps. It's all like God can stop for kind of. I really like the reveal of Freddy being an actor. Kill children that they burned alive.
The sort of the sins of the father and all that sort of stuff. I like that. That element is interesting. And I like the fact that the parents are so trying to cover it up, and that it's clearly having an impact on them. It's clearly probably, it's most likely what caused Nancy's parents to get divorced. Almost certainly, if not her mother's alcoholism, which was probably caused by that.
Yeah, no, her mother is not, never helpful, always like she yeah, it's I don't think that character can either works, neither is the least bit likable, and I don't know what the point of it is. Like she's just like having her be an alcoholic that doesn't believe her daughter, or kind of is convinced that it's all gone. And I don't know. It just feels like a way to make it harder for Nancy without her mother being like an actual character.
I think I've always felt that in this movie. Like, she doesn't really feel like a person. She feels just like an obstacle to be scaled. Whereas compared to her father, who I think is a very well written, interesting character, and return of John Saxon to this podcast. I knew that he would be coming back this month somehow, and he. But yeah, he's great. And what do you know? He's playing a cop again. But yeah, and he brings the same thing that he brought to Black
No.
Christmas, though.
He he's he. It's weird because I didn't realize it was the same actor, but I'm
That.
like, yeah, it's the same cop.
He played a lot of cops, like so many cops during his time, and old West gunmen and things like that. So yeah, but yeah, he's playing kind of the same character, but he does a good job with it. So
Yeah, I think he does nail it. I think, and I do think again, the movie is filled with just like small moments that are like, oh yeah, you're just here to make it a bit harder, and it's almost, it's not, it doesn't make it scarier, it makes it kind of feel less believable or a bit funnier even.
I can see
Like
that.
the bars on the window is, and her just like trying to scream at at that dumb cop that is like, everything's all right, everything's all right. Is, I don't know, I don't feel that scene is done well enough to contribute to the tension instead of just being kind of dumb.
I feel that.
And I think also this is the first kind of rooting for the good kills.
Like, this is one where, and the kills are so creative also, so that you can't not, like, the is it Tina? Her death is on another level. Yeah, Tina, who sort of is the main character before Nancy takes over. It still works, her being flung across that room and just, yeah, the kinetic nature of that. She's great in that scene, and you can feel the pain in that.
Yeah.
So she's good in that specific moment. She really plays that part really well. And even her boyfriend, or I can't remember if they were actually boyfriend, girlfriend or not, but they're sort of, yeah, he's doing a great job reacting to what he's seeing.
And I think the when young Johnny Depp gets like like
when he gets pulled into the bed
and just blood comes out,
it's so good.
It is actually really good.
It's so well done. And if anybody out there hasn't seen the documentary Never Sleep Again, they talk about that scene and how that scene caused their set to tip over because they didn't counterweight it properly. But it's pretty great. But that kill is pretty spectacular. I think his name is Rod Lane, this is sort of the boyfriend of Tina. His death is kind of, it's fine. It's creative at least, so that's something. Because he's the one who gets hung in the jail cell, I believe.
I like the ending. I'm not sure about what I'm supposed to take from it. Like, but I think I did. Like Freddy won, she's dead. Not dead, but just in the weird. Oh yeah, no, she died.
I've always taken. I don't know. My interpretation has always been that the ending was just a nightmare.
That it wasn't
necessarily actually Freddy. That it was sort of the aftershocks of Freddy. That's how I've always interpreted it. And that she really win.
That makes a lot more sense, actually. That she won, but now she'll have PTSD for the rest of her life and probably nightmares for a while, too.
You can take it both ways, I think.
That's a good way to see it. It makes way more sense than what I thought. Which was like, I'm not sure.
But when it first aired in the theaters, taking it as, oh, Freddy still got you, that's an interesting way to have people leave the audience, leave the theater, I mean. I've always loved that's sort of the resolution, though, before that. It's not her stabbing him with anything, it's not her, any number of things that could have happened. She doesn't, stick his head into a blender to kill him at the end. She says, I'm not giving you power anymore. You are not going to be my boogeyman anymore. I reject you. And that's how she wins in the end.
She just turned her back on him and stopped caring.
Yeah.
And that's a really strong ending.
Yeah. It's a very clever way to end a movie. It gives you both. It gives you something to think about at the end, and it's sort of a lot like Halloween. It has an idea, and it has a lot on its mind, and it has a theme, but it also has all the gore and all the violence of Friday the 13th. So I think that's part of why it holds up so well. And there's a lot of shots in this movie that are just gorgeous. Freddy coming through that wall almost is still really, really freaky. His hand coming through the water and all that. Like, there's some very good stuff, just visual stuff that's really interesting.
Sequels, that's the question I always want to ask.
Oh, see, What are the sequels like? I personally enjoy the third one because Nancy comes back. Spoilers. Not really a spoiler, but she comes back and she helps another generation of kids that are dealing with Freddy. And yeah, it does some interesting stuff with her. There's some progression, and you get that sort of PTSD that I was talking about. That's you see her like dealing with it and realizing, oh, he's back. He, of course, he went after other kids. Why wouldn't he go after other kids? Yeah, so that movie's good. I haven't watched the other ones past that, other than New Nightmare, because I've heard only uninteresting things. Nightmare on Elm Street 2 is an insane movie. and I think I told you this before. You should watch it if you're drunk. That's the best way to watch that movie. Because it breaks a lot of the rules that are established in the first movie. There's this... It's not even subtext. It's very much text that Freddy is in this relationship with the main character. And he's basically figured out a way to use the main character to kill people while they're awake by taking over his body. And he also kills people while they're asleep as well. But that's a power that he gains that is never revisited until Freddy versus Jason. so yeah, like it's a weird movie, and there's a lot of very homosexual imagery. Yeah, that's the best way to describe it. It's an interesting movie, to say the least. So yeah.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
Anything else?
No, I think we've mostly covered it, I guess. I guess if I have any sort of notes on these movies, it's that these are sort of these are some of the good, you know, my first horror movies. These ones and the slash movies we talked about, and, you know, the list that we did the week before this. So if you're someone who's been listening to all of our Halloween stuff, and this is, and you've watched any of it, and it's given you an interest in horror, keep going. That would be my sort of suggestion. Don't stop watching horror movies after Halloween passes. Keep watching them. You don't have to watch them all the time, but, you know, steady stream. Keep life interesting.
I think watching more horror, it definitely makes me appreciate it more. Appreciate more also the really good ones, the ones that stay with you.
Yeah. I think, and I've said this many times before, so if I'm a broken record, sue me. The best horror is, it's just a drama with elements that are horrific. And that's why some of them hold up better than others, because some of them, they aren't thinking about that. They aren't thinking about the characters and making you care about what you're seeing on screen. And a lot of the movies we've talked about this month so far have done that. So, and that's why they keep coming back.
We can do plugs.
Yeah,
I'll start and just say follow me on Twitter. I'm at Isayer, and that's it for this week.
Next week, our preview episode for Monster Mash should be coming out. So that should be happening. Episode 1 on Halloween. Phantom Zone every week. Yeah, you know where it is. So yeah, that's the show.
I ask again, is there going to be a Venom movie special?
Probably not.
Oh. Okay. That's my reaction.
Fair. But yeah, no, probably. probably not, for reasons that have, yeah, for things, reasons, lots of different reasons, mostly having to do with Daredevil and other things that are going on.
Here's my advice for this week. Go watch a movie. Go watch, like, a good movie. Go watch, like, Bad Times at El Royale or First Man or something like that. And if you, when you come out, it's halfway through Venom, get in there and just watch Tom Hardy be Tom, great Tom Hardy. And that's the best part.
Yeah. I'm going to agree completely with that statement, except I will redact the part about First Man. But yes, oh, no, definitely.
Okay. I haven't seen either of these films. I just mentioned two things.
I know. I have strong feelings about one of those films. In terms of maybe...
Way more curious about First Man, actually.
Yeah. But yeah, no, the second half of Venom is... It's very fun. I suggest people do watch it eventually.
It's a movie that works despite itself. That's what I've been saying.
That's accurate.
Fuck Roland Emmerich.
Bye.